This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Borders, presenting books, music, and movie gift ideas from The Gift Squad. Details at bordersgifts.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks, check it out.
This week on The Business, what happens when a film director known for comedy with a human touch makes his first special effects spectacular? We'll revisit our conversation with Sean Levy, whose experience directing Cheaper by the Dozen and The Pink Panther did almost nothing to prepare him for his new Christmas release, A Night at the Museum. Plus, guns, the low-tech movie effect we all love. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. Sean Levy is the veteran director of live-action, non-CGI comedies like Cheaper by the Dozen and The Pink Panther. The closest thing he'd come to special effects was the fake mustache on the face of Steve Martin's Inspector Clouseau. So he was reluctant when the people at Fox approached him about directing a big-budget special effects comedy about a security guard at the museum where dinosaurs and dioramas come to life. But Fox was persistent, and Levy finally agreed to make the picture. A Night at the Museum, starring Ben Stiller, Robin Williams, and Owen Wilson, opens Christmas Day.
Freaking awesome. This is a museum. I cannot tolerate this type of chaos.
We talked to Sean Levy earlier this year. Sean Levy, good to see you.
Good to be back here. Thank you.
Welcome to The Business.
Thank
again.
You.
Describe the difference between a movie like The Pink Panther and a movie like Night at the Museum.
The big difference for me is that you can't really wing it. There's no winging it, right? Like, if it's just Steve Martin and Jean Reno and Kevin Kline, and the premise is that they're going to torment Kevin's Dreyfus character, you know the scene, you basically know the lines, you might have a sense of where you want people in the room, but you're going to find the scene with the actors on the day. In a visual effects movie, and obviously the budgetary risks are much higher also, you need a very hard plan. And for a guy like me, who came to this genre new, and really, you know, totally kind of fresh. The best advice I got was my fellow producer on this movie is Chris Columbus. And early on, I had a lunch with Chris, who went from, you know, the Mrs. Doubtfires and Home Alones to Harry Potter. And I said, look, dude, I don't really know, frankly, anything about how to make a movie like this on this scale. And he said, neither did I. Here's the thing. Your main job is to know what you want. What do you want the movie to look like? What do you want the shot to contain and communicate? Draw that up. Be a rigorous storyboarder, more than you've ever done. And then you hand that over to the people who do know the language. And then what happens is you end up learning the language of the how. But what's critical is that you start off with the decisive what. That is to say, what do I want on the movie screen? And then you have a team of people who help you get there.
Now, before you sat down with Chris Columbus, Fox came to you a few times to ask you to do this. And your reaction was emotionally what?
Well, emotionally, rationally, physiologically, no frickin' way. And I don't even know if I can say that.
You can. You can say frickin'.
Or as we do in the family genre, freakin'. That's F-R-E-A-K-I-N apostrophe.
Gotcha.
That makes it palatable to the family crowd.
To the kids, yeah.
Just a trick of the
trade. It's a family show.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Trick of the trade. So,
But you're sort of abject terror? Was that?
No, I mean, literally, they sent me this script in various iterations, I think not less than four times. And every time I resisted. I resisted on the script level. I resisted when the very heads of the studio took me out to lunch to make a very compelling argument on why it was the right next move for me. And I guess that it boiled down to a fear of the scale, a fear of not only the amount of money that is at risk in movies like this, but more critically for me, if you're a person who likes to be in control, the idea of doing something that requires a skill set that you don't possess, right? That speaks in a language that you literally just don't know the vocabulary. That's daunting. What ultimately got me over that hurdle was in realizing that actually the reason they kept coming and the reason that this felt like the right move for me was this is first and foremost a father-son kind of heartfelt comedy.
And that you know how to do.
That I know how to do, right? I've done that. And even though it still has all that big complicated wrapping, the father-son story, the poignance of that, that was my way in. The rest was to be learned.
I'm reminded of I once spoke to a rear admiral in our fine Navy, and, you know, he'd started out sailing sailboats and, you know, now commanded a very sizable aircraft carrier. And he said, you know, the first time you're on the deck of this thing, you know, your inclination is to look for where the wheel is, you know, because we've got to point this thing somewhere. And there's no wheel. What I want to ask you is, what did you think it would be like? I mean, and what did it turn out to be?
You know, that's a good question. I thought that I would draw my storyboards, hand them over to the crack team of visual effects, you know, technicians and artists, and we would show up on set, and everyone would just tell Ben and I what to do, where to put the camera, and how to achieve that little drawing that I did. It wasn't that clean. It wasn't that simple because it still required a lot of finding answers on the fly. Like, let's say I had this idea that the T-Rex skeleton would, you know, run by Ben, wagging his tail excitedly, hit Ben in the stomach, and send Ben sliding back on his rear end across the floor. Okay, we get in the set. Suddenly, sliding back on your rear end, that doesn't work. You got a staircase there. The physics of where the T-Rex's height would connect with Ben's solar plexus, that doesn't work. So there we are on a day like that going, okay, so suddenly let's rip up the storyboard. What can we do? And that happened many times a day. And in those moments, it came down to, and this is comforting, by the way, it comes down to you as a director and your actor sitting there. You got 140 people waiting for an answer. What's the next move? And a lot of it came down to the same stuff that happens on a non-effects movie, which is Ben and I looking around us, looking at the set and going, okay, well, how about this? How about if the T-Rex connects with you right kind of in the upper chest area, sends you into a 720 backflip up into the air where you land on the marble staircase at the top of the staircase, and then you bumpity 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 down the staircase on your stomach, you know, landing hard in a heap. So suddenly, there's no plan for that, right? We come up with a creative, and then, yes, you bring in your visual effects team to go, okay, guys, we have a different idea. So I guess I was comforted by the fact that there is a wheel. There is a wheel. Yes, you're surrounded by computers that you don't quite understand, but the wheel is the creative idea. The wheel is the kind of, you know, tiny image that comes to you on the fly as a result of that environment, that actor, and what would be funny, what would feel right. And it's a small course correction, and then you're turning a big ship with that new idea, right, with that wheel. But the creative idea is still the wheel, and I was comforted by the need for it and the existence of that. By the way, that scene that I just described is the first teaser trailer of Night at the Museum, and that shot that I've just described is in the trailer. So a little show and tell coming at you soon.
I love it. Is the dirty little secret about these movies that often the most unplanned thing winds up being the best part of it?
I wish that I'm genuinely curious whether that's the case, because I do know for a fact that because I favor an improvisational style and Ben Stiller, in addition to our other cast members who include, you know, Owen Wilson and Ricky Gervais and Robin Williams, there were a lot of improvisational comic minds on this set. That said, my visual effects team repeatedly told me in kind of frazzled terms that Night at the Museum was among, if not the most, improv-heavy visual effects movie they've ever been on. So I'll tell you that the dirty little secret on our movie is that while we respected the plan, if a better idea occurred to Ben or I or any of our other cast members on the day, we were going to turn that ship. I'll give you another example. There's a scene where Ben has to lock up the Hall of African Mammals, and the script described him coming in one end of the room, locking the gate, turning around, and realizing, oh my goodness, I'm now locked in here with 20 African, you know, mammals, many of whom are vicious, and I need to get across this room to lock the other gate. The obvious problem is, why wouldn't he just lock the first gate from the outside, walk around to the other gate, and lock that one? Literally, this is a fundamental logic thing that was in the script for years. No one caught it. No one caught it. Not me, not any of the actors, not anyone at the studio. So there we are shooting the scene that had existed on the page for a long, long time. And I go, okay, Ben, so you come in here, you lock the gate, you turn, whoa, there's lions and bears, and you got to get across the room. And Ben's like, wait, why would I lock myself in from the inside? And it's like crickets, right?
Just the needle goes off the record.
I mean, and those are the moments where, again, you got not only your star asking you a very legitimate question, but you have 100-plus people looking for an answer, and you got nothing. Which, by the way, every director has those moments, and those moments are what define you as a director, because you can never kind of show and succumb to the fear of those moments. That said, so there Ben and I are, and we're like, okay, good question. How about you come in, you see the room's filled with African mammals, you go to run out, right, because that's the logical thing to do, but suddenly a woolly mammoth is there, blocking your exit, takes his trunk, shoves you into the room. Now the mammoth is coming at you, so you have to lock him out, which locks you in. I'm saying this to Ben, right? Cut to the 9 visual effects people in the corner, literally freaking out because suddenly what? I've just added a 6-figure woolly mammoth to the scene, but it was required. It makes the scene better, but there was no plan for this. So yeah, sometimes you just figure it out as you go along.
I'm speaking with Sean Levy, director of comedies like Cheaper by the Dozen and The Pink Panther. His first big effects movie called A Night at the Museum arrives in theaters on Christmas Day. Let's talk about the blue screen or the green screen or whatever color screen it is, and the way that you have to direct one of these movies, sometimes with an actor who is holding something that doesn't exist yet or who is reacting to something that isn't there. What are the challenges of that? How do you respond to nothing?
Well, it's hard because day after day, Ben was doing scenes with nothing. And some actors can fake it, like, oh my God, the T-Rex is chasing me down the hallway, ah, right? And it's that kind of thing where you run and you fake looking scared. So we realized early that Ben, and every actor is different, Ben functions better, Ben is better reacting to something real. So whether it was him running from a dinosaur or acting opposite a 3-inch tall Owen Wilson cowboy or getting shoved in the back by a woolly mammoth, we did everything we could to give Ben real things to react to, which is to say I played every part in the movie that didn't exist. And as a result, there was a lot of off-screen kind of self-humiliation on my part, because if Ben was supposed to be chased by a T-Rex, we just realized, Ben and I, early that he just wasn't as funny, wasn't as real, running from nothing. So often it was me on a ladder being wheeled by grips, going rawr with my little hands, you know, like cupped by my chest to simulate T-Rex talons, whatever it took to evoke a real reaction. They would then paint me out and put in the T-Rex. So it's a lot of acting opposite simulated reality.
Well, if you talk to studio heads, most directors are described in reptilian terms, so I guess you have some advantage.
It wasn't a big stretch, but literally, it was in some way the purest form of directing for us, because it was your job as a director is to give your actor what he or she needs. In a case like this, I was literally coming up with whatever Ben needed to feel a real reaction, and there was a lot of that.
As you're doing all of this, you're improvising. You're saying, look, I know it's going to cost money. I know that we've just added $1 million. In 6 breaths, we've just added $1 million. Are you cognizant? Can you even allow yourself to be cognizant of what am I doing to my career? I am doing whatever I want to do with this studio's money. And the crew that's making this movie with me is telling me it's the most improvisational movie they've ever worked on, and they've worked on dozens, if not hundreds, of these movies. Is there a point where you go, oh my God, what am I doing?
You can't. You can't think in those terms. It's like any actor will tell you, if they're in the waiting room of an audition and they look around at 30 other people who look faintly like them, if you let the thought get into your head, well, why would it be me? Why wouldn't it be these other people? You're dead. Similarly, if you go into directing a movie like this and you think about, oh, the risk I'm putting to my career, or the risk, you want to be responsible, but you can't ever, at least for me, I can't think of the scale in those terms, because then you paralyze yourself. You have to live in this kind of ivory tower of creativity with, yes, some cognizance of kind of responsibility, of course. But if you think in terms of those scary thoughts, the daunting kind of scope of how much is at stake, I think there's no way for you not to be squeezing off your creative pipeline. So for me, you live in one headspace while you're making it, and you try not to let those thoughts creep in.
Did you have those thoughts before you made the movie? I mean, did your agents tell you, look, there's a risk here that we are taking by, you know, you're good at something. You have a proven track record with a certain kind of movie. You could go on making that kind of movie happily for the next 30 years, become very, very wealthy, live a very good life, and you're sort of, you're staking a lot of political capital on this. Did anyone have that conversation with you?
People had that conversation with me. However, it was almost in the context of, it's my job to point this out. That said, the same people who represent any creative person hopefully understand that nobody becomes a director. I mean, I guess some people become a director just to get rich and live a comfortable life. But presumably most of us come from, at least initially, a genuine creative urge place. And that same place is going to want newness, right? That same urge is going to want different challenges. And so I didn't really think about the scale and the intimidation that came from it. You know what intimidated me? What intimidated me was, I don't want to try something new and not be good at it. That is a more intimidating thought. The idea of kind of failing yourself and, what if you can't master this new skill set? Those were the scarier thoughts. And those are the ones that I had to get over to do this job well.
More than movie jail.
Much more than movie jail. Probably because if you have a few hits under your belt, you know, you can make bail. You can make bail, and you can survive one that misses. Although, frankly, early on, I had the sense that this one, if we get it right, it ain't going to miss. It's going to hit, and I think hit big.
You want to do it again?
That's an interesting question. Do I want to do it again? I'll say this. As the effects start to trickle in now, and I'm seeing images that I can't create without the help of this effects team, right? Now that I see that actual skeletal T-Rex tail hitting Ben, sending him flying head over heels into that staircase, it's pretty amazing to be able to paint on that big a canvas. And cliche though that is, it really is pretty awesome to have untethered imagination, right? Unlimited creativity, where you're not restricted by any kind of boundaries of, well, we can't do that, because now you can actually do anything.
So that's a yes?
I think that might be a yes.
Coming up after a short break, more with Sean Levy, director of the special effects comedy blockbuster, A Night at the Museum. You're listening to The Business from NPR. Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. directing comedies like Cheaper by the Dozen did nothing to prepare Sean Levy for his first big effects movie, A Night at the Museum. It comes out Christmas Day. You are a unique choice for this kind of movie. Do you have a sense that studios are coming around to the idea of taking the smarter comedy director or the more avant-garde film director and sort of dropping them in via a crane atop these vast aircraft carriers, that this is something that they want to do more of? And I mention it in light of the disaster at sea that was Poseidon. And the knock on the movie was that there was not the improvisation or complexity of character or story, or maybe it was with the script, or I don't know if it's all to be laid at the feet of this one director. But is that, do you get a sense that the studios are changing the way that they make these big movies and looking to different directors like yourself?
Well, I do. You know, I don't know whether it started with Peter Jackson, but when you have a guy go from Heavenly Creatures to Lord of the Rings, I think it teaches pretty inarguably that what one has done is not fully reflective of what one can do. And I think that, look at, you got Chris Weitz right now, director of About a Boy and American Pie, doing Golden Compass. You have a guy like me doing Night at the Museum. You have Tim Story, you know, going from Taxi and Barbershop to Fantastic Four. And, you know, we're all different directors, but I do think that there is a sense on the part of studios that the language of the technical can be learned, but the language of character, the language of comedy, the language of story isn't as easily learned. So I do think that we're seeing more and more, quote unquote, non-effects directors directing effects movies because, as I said, the technical, there's a vast team surrounding you to help you figure that stuff out. But there's only certain aspects of filmmaking that no one can help you with. No one can help you with. That is the performances, the actors, and just kind of an intuitive sense of how you're going to tell these stories about these characters in a way that you care about. So you better have that skill set if you're going to make a movie on this scale. And I do think that that's something that we're seeing more and more of.
Sean Levy is the director of Cheaper by the Dozen, Big Fat Liar, and The Pink Panther. His first special effects-filled film, called A Night at the Museum, opens Christmas Day. Coming up next on The Business, guns go to the movies. Movie stars may fall in and out of favor, but moviegoers have always had a love affair with guns. In sci-fi epics, western yarns, cop flicks, swashbucklers, war movies, even the occasional romantic comedy, guns are everywhere. On the big screen, they're tossed around like a bag of peanuts at a Cubs game. But on the set of a movie or TV show, guns are treated with great respect. Earlier this year, we sent producer Thea Challoner out into the world to find out more.
The hand prop room in Culver City is filled with stuff for the movies, from antique luggage to plastic replicas of deli meats and cheeses. In the back is a very large room filled with guns, a lot of them, enough guns to make a Sam Peckinpah movie or to mount a sizable insurrection. Now, I have always hated guns, but when the hand prop room's gun guy, Andreas, put an M16 machine gun in my hands, I have to admit, it felt good.
Loud noise!
This was a prop gun, blanks, no bullets, but still it was a big rush.
Okay.
I didn't think about causing damage or getting hurt. I just wanted to do it again. But these guns can do serious damage. Take, for instance, John Eric Hexum, the 26-year-old actor who accidentally killed himself by firing a prop gun at his temple.
Everybody knows what a real weapon or real gun is capable of. Everybody thinks that because it's just blanks, they're completely safe, so they do stupid, ridiculous things with them.
Rock Galati is a well-known movie weapons specialist. He helps filmmakers choose what guns to use in a movie, and he's responsible for their safe use on the set. He's headquartered in a highly fortified mobile armory located behind a supermarket in Simi Valley.
It's completely secure, steel-lined. It's got security doors on it, in and out, that are steel. It's got
the armory is about as big as a medium-sized RV. On the inside, instead of a kitchen and a couch, there are neat rows of hanging guns, grenade launchers, and plastic tubs filled with earplugs and flak jackets. A huge POW flag is pinned to the wall. Rock was a cop and a Marine who served in the first Gulf War.
So they kind of illuminate the battlefield at night so you can try to see the bad guys so they don't sneak up on you.
Okay.
And do a little jihad on you or something.
Rock works most often with director John Woo, known for Hong Kong action classics like The Killer and A Bullet in the Head. They met in 1993 on the set of Hard Target, Woo's first Hollywood film. It was a match made in heaven. Woo, a self-proclaimed pacifist, and Galati, a war veteran, both obsessed with the look, feel, and design of guns. While many gun specialists simply provide guns and supervise their use on set, Rock's known for creating spectacular weapons.
I mean, look what I did in Face Off. 24-karat gold-plated guns for Nicolas Cage and put dragons on the grips with rubies in the eyes. You know, I was talking to Nick, and he's like, yeah, so I want to go with, like, gold dragons. And I'm like, okay, cool, how about gold guns? And he's like, oh, that'd be totally cool. You think John would go for it? And I went and talked to John, and John went, oh, yeah, that is, oh, yeah, gold gun, very good, okay.
Modifying and creating guns is only one part of Rock's job. The other part is training actors how to handle them, so that they look like they know what they're doing, so it's dramatic, and so nobody gets hurt. The mere arrival of a weapon on a set is announced loudly by the assistant directors, and another announcement is made when the guns are loaded with blanks. The weapons specialist is the only person on a set, other than maybe a director or producer, who won't take any guff from even the biggest stars. Their safety depends on it.
I need the actors to get into the frame of mind where they're military, they draw their own weapons, and they're not being lollycoddled with their Perrier and garbage like that.
Two telltale signs an actor doesn't know what he's doing: the wince, where the actor's face grimaces with every shot, or the manipulator, when the actor tries to exaggerate the gun's power.
He's trying to shake the weapon like it's kicking and it's recoiling. You'll never do it right, so don't even try. When you start shaking the weapon and jiggling it around or holding it like somebody that...
Go ahead and say it.
People would be so proud of me right now because usually I spit it out. If you're holding it like a little baby, like a little girl, your weapon's going to malfunction.
So say you're talking to a ginger soul. Say, I'm guessing that would be more of the female actresses that you deal with, perhaps, in terms of handling weapons. Safe to say?
One of the best people I've ever trained who came out to be a real badass was Carrie Ann Moss, who played Trinity in The Matrixes. She hates weapons. She hates them, and she's so good with them. And I really did nothing. Some people... Some actors, I have to sit there and I pump them up before a scene. They want me to talk about things. They want me to help them get pumped.
Rock's not just responsible for working with elite actors, but anyone on set who'll be handling a gun.
So say you have 40 or 50 extras coming to the back of your trailer. How do you educate a large group in terms of handling weapons?
If it's a lot of guys, no women, I talk like a guy to them.
Give me an example of that.
I don't think we can say that on the radio.
What's the gist?
The gist of it is basically, you know, they're told, you know, you up with my weapon, I'm going to shove it up your ass and make it look like a damn popsicle stick coming out your basically, that's the gist.
This might sound a little extreme until you consider the fact that Rock's a military man. Shooting correctly is about honoring, as he puts it, his military brothers and sisters. And whether it's blanks or bullets, there's always potential danger.
The bottom line is we don't want anybody hurt. Yeah. I mean, it's not worth killing somebody or injuring somebody for a lousy $8-$9 movie ticket.
For The Business, this is Thea Challoner.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.